Howdy everyone, welcome back to Warp Celluloid. I'm your host Jack Rourke with my co-host, as usual, as always, the great
Chandler Williams. Thank you, Jack.
Great to have you back, man.
Yeah, great to be on.
I'm really excited because, if I'm not mistaken, the last time we did a Linklater title was about 3 years ago, correct?
Yes, we did another rotoscoped Linklater, Scanner Darkly, but yeah, today we're going to be talking about Waking Life.
Your life is yours to create.
Yeah, maybe I only exist in your mind. I'm still just as real as anything else.
It seemed like I'd walked into an alternate universe.
You haven't met yourself yet.
I'm trapped.
I want real human moments. I want to see you.
I'm not in an objective, rational world.
You can have any kind of sex you want. Seems like everyone's sleepwalking through their waking state or wakewalking through their dreams.
So, you produce a neo-human, the individual no longer restricted by time and space.
I'm just trying to get like a sense of where I am.
Just wake up.
Do you remember me?
When I say love, the sound comes out of my mouth and it hits the other person's ear, travels through their memories of love or lack of love.
It's like I'm being prepared for something.
I am a passenger.
Really romantic evenings of self, I go salsa dancing with my confusion.
Everyone knows fun rules.
You can do whatever you want to.
Everything is possible.
You a dreamer?
You know it looks so good tonight.
Yeah, I haven't seen too many of you around lately.
Oh, the passenger.
It's weird. I felt like I've lived with this one for a while. I mean, this is one of those titles like Days of Confusion Boyhood. Like, this is one of the great Linklater titles I kept hearing about. And I'm like, I mean, it's stuck in the back of my mind is that, but yeah, having seen it recently, I get, I mean, the hype behind this. This is a beautiful movie. And I, if it sounds like I'm at a loss for words, well, it's because I am. I mean, so Chandler, I shall leave it to you to dig into this one proper.
Yeah, I mean, I also, like we were talking about before we started recording, I have a lot of notes on this movie because there's just so much to talk about. There's so much to dive in and discuss about this film. I would consider this a cult classic as well. You have a Letterboxd list of 20th century cult classics, and I think this definitely deserves a spot on it. I saw this film for the first time a couple months ago, and it really, really hit me. I've lived in Austin for almost 2 years now, and so it was really cool to recognize several of the spots in this movie. I'm like, oh yeah, I go to that coffee shop all the time, or I've been to that bakery plenty of times, or I go to that theater fairly often, and yeah, it was cool in that respect for sure. But
would you call this one of the great Austin movies?
I would consider most of his films great Austin movies. I mean, definitely Days Confused, definitely Slacker. Yeah, I would consider this an Austin movie. Maybe not as much as Days Confused or Slacker, but like if you know the spots, it's really cool to see them animated on screen. But I would consider this also one of his more experimental films. I mean, obviously, but I think a lot of his films are experimental in a, you know, not entirely like traditional experimental way. Or like when I think of experimental film, he's not the first thing that comes to mind, but I think this definitely is experimental in its narrative form, as well as just you know, obviously the visual style and the animation, but just the way we jump around from conversation to conversation and from monologue to monologue in a way that is a lot like Slacker. And I'm sure we're going to talk a lot about Slacker throughout the
episode.
Oh,
we're definitely going to get into Slacker, trust me. Because it's funny that you mentioned that. I watched the commentary track for this, not the one with the animators, the one with Linklater, Wiley Wiggins, and the producers. Linklater himself views it as a parallel universe Slacker of sorts, and I think that's what hit me on this viewing, was this feels like him consciously trying to evolve that sort of winding, almost Altman-esque, like, anti-narrative. of sorts where we're just getting a sense of place.
Yeah, and to that point, I would consider it Austin, you know, because you have all these kind of eccentric characters.
Including one that has been mentioned on the show before.
Yes.
It's specifically in the Rotosco context.
Yes. And I'm sure we'll talk about him too. But I wrote down in my notes, this feels like a graduated form of Slacker stylistically, because it is far more concise and consistent in its themes. And not to say that Slacker is inconsistent, but it's like consistently inconsistent thematically. And so like all of its odd characters and monologues point to a larger picture of a sense of place and time of Austin in the mid early 90s. But this feels more graduated in the sense that it is far more consistent, and the monologues and kind of episodic bits blend into each other much more seamlessly. And yeah, there's overall a more concise theme of dreams and you know, arguments of existence and questions of God, and yeah, it's beautiful.
I have the feeling this one's going to grow on me over time, and with this viewing, that cement it, because one, there's the obvious factor of there's little things you notice on subsequent viewings, like, hey, there's that in the background, or what's he talking about this time, or, oh, that's based on a Hubert Selby novel. But the thing I think back to in regards to Slacker is that it's weirdly looser than Slacker, but also ultimately more cohesive, which is odd because Slacker was largely conceived as one thing, to my knowledge. And this was largely assembled from odds and ends that Linklater had been mulling over and marinating on for, I think, a decade at that point. And it's funny. I think the visual elasticity of the digital rotoscoping is the key that really unlocks this idea to its full potential.
Oh, yeah, because it does like hold on to that motif. I don't want to use the word gimmick, but motif of dreams. You know, this movie's submerging you in that like dreamlike realism, I would say, or like the dreamlike visual style, 100%. And like the animation style, the visual effects point to that. All over the place. Everything's constantly kind of moving in a dizzy way, and every time, I mean, like whenever I first put it on this past time to rewatch it, there was a few times in the beginning where I was like, whoa, 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 because the things in the background are just kind of swaying and moving in a very trippy way, but in a way that's, it's cool and it's not over the top, in a way that like beats you over the head, but it's still in a way that's very eccentric and accessible. But you know, it's hard to put into words. Yeah, I just have so many notes. I mean, this could go on for a while.
Hey man, the longer the better.
Yeah, I mean, like the inconsistencies in the visual style, and like clearly pointing to multiple animators and different styles of animation, I think that adds so much to it. To the sense of it being dreamlike.
It's funny that you call it inconsistency, because I view it as a sort of variety in a way. There's like 20 different people on this team, and each one of them, this rarely gets talked about within any field of animation. And yes, obviously teams are needed for this. You need people doing backgrounds, you need people doing like individual figures, certain people do certain sequences. Rarely do they get to let their voice be heard on as them. They don't really get to push into them. Like, there has to be some level of consistency. And here, I think, again, it's really makes what should be a bug into a defining feature. And by letting it just be this freewheeling, winding, lackadaisical, anything goes approach, you never know what you're going to hear or what you're going to see next. And there is, in a weird way, it's kind of exciting, I think.
It's very exciting. Yeah, I mean, inconsistencies is a harsh word to use. But it feels jumpy. There's in the best way, in a good way that works. There's a jumpy kind of eclectic visual style going on, because yeah, there are clearly so many different animation styles, like jumping in between the same cuts sometime, which is so cool and dreamlike, in a sense of like, you know, from a reality grounded realism sense, it is inconsistent, but in a way that like points more to the dream world. And, yeah, it's just so cool. It's so satisfying. Yeah, love it.
I think we want to look at this within his larger body of work, aside from Slacker. I find it interesting because Scanner Darkly is still my favorite of his Rotoscope trilogy. I find it the most impressive feat, as in, how did they adapt this unadaptable thing? How did they make it resonate in the here and now? But I also find it interesting because this is probably the least technically polished of the three. Like, if you look, watch them, like, sequentially, we're in Scanner Darkly, then Apollo 10 and a half. You see the rough edges start to get worked out, and you see him start to smooth it over into a thing that relatively feels well-honed by now. And as a result, the narratives tend to get more streamlined, to the point where Apollo 10 and a half is a pretty just straightforward memory piece. And for a while, I was just kept bouncing off, like, why do people insist on this being the best of the three? Now I think I'm starting to get it. I'm not sure if I quite agree to that extent, because I just have such an attachment to that Philip K. Dick book and the performances and the themes of that movie. But I don't want to undersell it. This movie really is brilliant and human, and despite being so interested, and there's a love for the people shown here. I mean, here, varying degrees, of course, but I think what balances out is that it is a wonderfully contradictory thing. You mentioned the dream motif, but the other motif I noticed was the constant thing of floating and levitation. Not just people floating, but these like weird languid, like aerial shots over the city, which, it's funny how this is such a conversational movie, and a lot of my favorite parts are the quiet bits where you just get to inhabit the space.
Yeah, for sure. I still haven't seen Apollo 10 and a half, which I should have before we started recording this, but
I want to add a caveat to my recommendation. It's definitely not as heavy as this. That's probably what I consider, alongside his recent film Hitman, which I'm not sure if you've seen yet. I know I'm definitely excited for it, but I classify it as Linklater having fun with it, and as that, it's really enjoyable and charming.
Cool. No, I've heard great things. I still need to see it, and he's one of my favorite directors. And I have seen Hitman, actually. I saw a test screening at the theater where I work, which is like his theater, but yeah, it was cool.
I'm still baffled by the decision to send that thing to Netflix, because everything I've been hearing about it over the last few months is saying, no, this is a crowd pleaser. This is something you put in theaters, makes a killing on opening weekend. I mean, Glenn Powell literally had a hit a few months with Anyone But You, which, say what you will about the quality of that movie, it did make bank for something that really doesn't make bank anymore. More, which is just star-led traditional studio comedies. So I'm hoping the best for it. I think this movie is really going to be something special, and it's nice to know that no matter how old Linklater gets or how far his career in the highs and lows, he always wants to challenge himself and challenge you what the idea of a Richard Linklater movie is. And that's true of
absolutely.
This too.
Absolutely. Very, very true of this. And I'm excited to see the final cut of Hitman, because I mean, I have thoughts about what I saw, and yeah, I'm excited to see the final product. But I mean, this feels like a far, far departure from something like Before Sunrise or Dazed and Confused even.
Well, not that far. I mean, Delpy and Hawk are in it.
They are in it, in like in such a cool, like, I don't know, Linklater world cinematic universe kind of cameo, which I think is so cool and commendable. But yeah, this feels like a bold departure from some of his previous films, excluding Slacker. But yeah, it's still distinctly him. You've got Pinball. The opening scene apart from the part with Lorelai, his daughter, and the kid.
With a little fortune teller?
Yeah, which is so cool. I mean, it's cool that he has his kids in his movies.
It's such a good, not just a good Austin hallmark, but a good, like, early 2000s hallmark with this is the clear transition from a pre-internet to a post-internet age, even if the internet isn't directly knowledge in it. You can feel like the technology shaping around it and just influencing what's to come. Now, not in a science fiction way, but more of a, this is a culture in transition.
Absolutely. And I mean, like the opening shot of him, I mean, the opening credits shot of Wiley waking up on the bus is the same as in Slacker with Linklater waking up on the bus. And you get the title card of Slacker. And then I just like how he's in his movies to varying degrees as well. But like, he's good in this. I mean, I love the boat car stuff.
The boat car is so good. I love that they like got a different animator and a different style for like each different shot that they cut to. I love that the boat guy, he feels like a Ralph Steadman painting come to life. In a weird way, where I'm just like this weird shaggy, like, hey man, you want to go for a ride? Let's go.
Yeah. I mean, a little 2001, not 2001, excuse me, a little Fear and Loathing reference there, esque, it felt like. But I mean, I also love how he uses some of the same actors in some of his movies. Like that, the guy that played the boat car man is the uncle in Boyhood. For that one party scene, whom I've met actually, and he's a really cool guy.
Nice.
Yeah, he's been to I've seen him at the theater a few times. Just the monologues in this movie are awesome, and like to the point of it being a graduated slacker stylistically, the monologues are fantastic, and I love how, I mean, you said the Robert Altman almost anti-narrative.
I'd say and Slacker have a very heavy Nashville feeling to them.
Yeah, languid for sure. I don't know. It's a great introduction to characters. You get like one scene with them, kind of explaining their like gestalt of their worldview, and I think there's an art of listening to people explain something they're passionate about or like talk about something they're passionate about, which is just universally beautiful. And universally attractive, that feels like pretty much this whole movie, which keeps it so entertaining and so fresh, in an experimental narrative way, because there's not like a three-act structure or hero's journey going on, but you're just kind of walking through his dream with him, which is beautiful. I'm gonna try to get back on my notes.
If I may go back to the Delpy and Hawk scene, I find it interesting that it works as like a nice little nod to the before movies, but also, and this is why I'm glad I listened to that commentary track, Linklater explicitly made it a rule, like, I'm not going to do this just for the sake of like basking in my old movies. I want something new to contribute and something to add to the overall experience. And if you pay attention to that scene, it's a really lovely conversation. It's very revealing. And it has a really difficult to process and but not exactly heavy view of life. It's a broader existential thing. It's the feeling of I also mentioned the whole floating motif, even the general feeling of everything is kind of detached from each other. I don't know how to describe this in animation style other than liquid. Because there is a thing that like things are just like moving into each other and bubbling up and blending in a way that it almost feels like a psychedelic oil pattern with much more naturalistic colors. It's always a thing that I feel like I need to adjust to whenever I throw them on, but once I've settled in, I could not be happier, because this really does feel alive.
Absolutely. The visuals just feel alive. They feel like flowy and kind of, I mean, liquid is a great word for it, and like kind of gooey in a way that's so vibrant and like constantly breathing. Also another motif of his films is like having a teacher or professor give a lecture or speak about their lesson or class, but then have that be a primary theme of the film, which he's done in so many movies, including Hitman.
Nice. It's funny how frequently I feel like we tend to go off on a tangent just because there's so much to talk about with a given film. But and frequently I keep telling myself, yeah, we're going to stay more focused this time. But with a movie like this, tangents are kind of the goal. Randy Gold, because, not just because of the winding narrative structure, just because of Randy, it's fascinating how much individual conversations with this open up broader ideas and expand upon them in there, but also leave room for you, the viewer, to interpret at your own leisure, I'd say.
Absolutely. And, I mean, I love how dreamlike this movie is. And, I mean, to the point of it being tangential, there are some scenes where it's just, like, a singular emotion, to where, like, it's a monologue just about a singular emotion, like rage, where you get the red guy who's in Slacker in the jail smoking the cigarette, just so angry. And I think that's very dreamlike, in a sense of just, he's just talking about how angry he is, and we're with him for just a few short minutes, but he's like, he's just red, and it's kind of funny how angry he is.
The other funny thing is that for a movie this peaceful and for this non-confrontational, it's hard to really put it into words exactly, but there is a very comfortable feeling watching this movie. But then there are like the weird, really dark moments based on urban legends and whatnot. And the thing that I find funny about that scene in particular, that's the scene that got the movie the R rating.
And, wow.
And because of just how grim it was. I have to imagine the guy who self-immolates also contributed to that. But man, it's funny how it has these wild tonal swings. And then it just, oh, now we're talking about the headiness of the universe again. And again, I'm like, wait, didn't that guy just set himself on fire? Like, what was the deal with that? There is like a sort of good natured dark humor to that, because we know it's not really happening. We know no one's really in danger for it, but it is a very brief flash of inner darkness that helps add the texture to the thing.
For sure, and that feels like the kind of like almost like a risky like languid nature of dreams in the first place. And I think of that other great scene with the two guys at the bar. And I actually watched a movie a few weeks ago, Scorsese's American Boys, Stephen Price documentary, and one of the conversations...
That was mentioned on the commentary. I was meaning to track that out.
Yeah, how was it? Okay, cool. Oh, it's fantastic. It was great. Just like a loose documentary about Scorsese just hanging out with some of his friends. And yeah, just interviewing Stephen Price, talking about stories, smoking pot, smoking cigarettes, and just... you know, drinking beer late at night, and they're just hanging out, talking about his life. But one of the stories he shares is the story about the gas station getting held up or getting robbed, and he shoots the guy robbing the tires or stealing the tires. And so I thought that was cool that I picked up on that. I felt proud of myself. But yeah, I mean, that's from that documentary. American Boy is where Tarantino got the overdose sequence from. Another fun fact.
It's funny you mentioned that, because I just watched Pulp Fiction with Shane a few weeks ago. Nice. It's funny. For all the talk of that being an essential dorm room classic, it's one of those rare movies that is just as good, if not better, than your dumb little buddies keep going on and on about, and you're like, all right, I get it. And then you throw it on and you're like, yeah, this thing still fucking slaps.
It's just so good. I watched it a few weeks ago as well. It's just great. But yeah, like Stephen Price talks about, you know, having to stab someone with a big adrenaline shot and putting, you know, some magic marker on her heart to like know the right spot. And yeah. It's great.
Do you think it would be fair to call this movie unclassifiable? Like genre-wise. Yeah.
Genre-wise, and I think that's for part sure. I think experimental is like the best kind of umbrella term for it. Yeah, I would say so.
There's another umbrella term I was thinking about with this, and it's a term I've been obsessed with for a while because no one can really ever have a solid definition for it, but there's definitely an undercurrent running throughout, specifically 21st century American cinema, and that term is docudrama. Mm. Because usually it's done for a particularly clinical particularly clinical and particularly like even-handed, like the most realistic and grounded type of like narrative films. Like think like Paul Greengrass, United 93. But when I think docudrama, I think take you as literally docudrama or in drama, like a or in a fictional context with like a. The best thing you can say about this movie is a thing I think you can say about all of Richard Linklater's film is its looseness and its authenticity.
Mm. Yeah, for
sure.
And
that's how you get that.
It feels so human and so real, and I think that's a point to we're spending like so much authentic time with people with these characters that we only see for, you know, a scene or two, but they're kind of spilling their heart out, which is so beautiful. And so, you know, we have so much compassion for them because they're like speaking so passionately about something they love, or topics they love. And, even though it's dark or funny sometimes, I mean, we're there with them and we feel for them. And I just love the Alex Jones bit. And I recognize some of the streets that he's driving down. That's so funny that he's in it. And it's just, it's
especially funny considering where he ended up like 20 years later.
Yeah. But I mean, like, it's just funny that he's in this and, he's just going off in like a classic classic Alex Jones, you know, riff about like freedom and, you know, not going to be like oppressed.
The chemtrails in the water turning the frogs gay.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, buy my boner pills. I swear the FDA has approved these.
Yeah, but he doesn't even get that kind of kooky. I feel like he's kind of reeled in this one a little bit.
Which is funny because from the commentary track, from what I learned, he basically just let Rand Jones do his thing and Rand went unsupervised with the whole thing. Like, do whatever you want in front of the camera. I just want to get it, make sure it's captured.
Yeah, it's perfect. I think it's hilarious and yeah, pretty tame for Alex Jones, but like still inspiring in a, you know, in a tame Alex Jones way, because he's like, you know, freedom and I don't know. It's just funny.
His usual libertarian gobbledygook.
Yeah, and he like, and I think that he's changing colors. He's like, he turns like red and purple and kind of blue, and it's just cool. And like to picture him in like a, you know, a classic 50s car, but like with speakers on it, just like screaming,
just driving around like the local nut, which I think is worth remembering specifically for this movie, because did this come out before or after 9/11? I'm trying to remember.
This was 2002, I want to say.
I'm just doing me being me, my professional self, and Googling this during the show.
Yeah.
And the date is, not ignoring the Sundance, was October 19th. Shit, a month after 9/11.
Oh, okay, wow.
And I want to hype
I guess the physical like that because
that's where you see a change in Jones's cultural image. Because before this, he's largely known as a local figure, someone mostly amusing, like a fixture of the public access circuit, not someone with a particularly wide influence. And you see that warp and change over time, and I really liked watching this after having lived with the Scanner Darkly for a while and knowing he appears in that, because one, he's depicted more abstractly here, just like a red face in a car. If you didn't know anything about Alex Jones going into this, you could entirely be forgiving for not recognizing it, but Scanner Darkly more cunningly uses his public image in that respect as a guy like, they're coming to take us all down. It's a land of contrasts, as the old shittily written, half-assed, written at the 11th hour high school essay way of phrasing things.
And, I mean, comparing his monologue in this versus the one, his rant in A Scanner Darkly, in the one in A Scanner Darkly, he rips far more on, you know, Substance D. Is it Substance D?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like he riffs on that and, you know, It's more contextually fitting within the film. Not to say that this one isn't, but he fits in like this beautiful scope of characters just like talking about what they're passionate about or just kind of like riffing off for a little bit in a more abstract sense. And it just, I don't know. it's just satisfying and funny and just beautiful. You know, it's a great little episode within this film. And I say episode because the segments do feel a little episodic in a good way. I mean, not to say that they don't flow together, but they're very confined and separate for the most part, excluding Wiley, and kind of detached, but in a way that complements the piece as a whole.
It is a series of vignettes that are ultimately linked thematically, which is, I think, the earned theme. This is a movie that why I get so hung up on character and theme over plot mechanics, because the obvious point is when you get too pedantic about what's happening and why, it can get a little boring. But broadly, if you have a through line this strong and that feeling of interconnectivity and scope, regardless of how well everything actually feeds into each other, like how does this character relate to this, you still have something that's perfectly enjoyable as is.
Absolutely. And comparing this to something like Tree of Life, which is one of my all-time favorites, it does feel very much like a director bouncing off these questions of existence, or, you know, bouncing off these questions of a specific topic, but showing them through the faces of people who are, you know, posing different answers, all pointing to the same question. And for this, it feels like, you know, a question of existence and reality and God for sure. But it feels like, you know, Linklater's personal questions, that he's just kind of bouncing off, through a film. And it feels almost like kind of a visual journal, a visual diary at times, especially with his ending monologue, which I think is just so fantastic and easily my favorite part of the movie, except for maybe the Alex Jones part, just because it's so funny. Well, also, I love the Cave moment, and I wrote some notes about that. I've been to that theater a few times, which was really cool to see, the Paramount Theater. It's like a historic Austin staple. Very cold in there. They keep it very chilly. But it was cool to see that on the screen. And the first time I watched this movie, that the Cave segment made me buy Bosnan's books, What is Cinema, Volume 1 and 2, which are fantastic. I highly recommend them. Just, you know, some deep film theory discussions. But the holy moment bit, I just love, and like how they turn into clouds at the end. But also his hair is just kind of wavy.
I was gonna say that image of them turning into the clouds really sticks with me.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? And I'm glad you decided to focus on that, because for as much as this is a meditation on life, it is also a meditation on art. What goes into making it, how it affects people, and really just the whole. Again, there's an interconnectivity supporting the whole thing, which regardless of how unstructured or loose it feels, and I don't want to say chaotic, because again, I view this as a very calm, comforting viewing, but there is a anything goes sporadic nature to the thing, and it really, this is one of those movies that, I hate to use the old cliche of this is why I love movies, but it really is liberating to watch unfold in front of your eyes when you can see someone this confident in an idea, and you just... The other thing, I'm not sure if we really mentioned this, there is not a single hint of judgment whenever any of these people are shown. Even Alex Jones, who probably deserves judgment at this point, Linklater lets them speak. There's no hint of condescension, there's no hints of any things like which one does he agree with, which one doesn't he, and for another filmmaker, this could come off as unfocused, but here... It feels, there's a feeling of generosity.
Absolutely. And it's extremely objective. Like, even the man in jail who's just like pure rage, you know, it's an objective view on all these ideas. And I think that's just beautiful and adds like to the comfort of this film. And, there's also such a wide range of, situations and characters that play out. Like, I go to that coffee shop all the time where the two women are discussing, you know, dreams and what they thought their life was going to turn out. And I compared that to like the Fight Club-esque group of four dudes walking down the street, and like they're going on their or like it seems like they're repeating a mantra of, you know, self-liberty and free will and not being oppressed by the, you know, bureaucratic systems or whatnot. And they see the dude on the flagpole or the dude on like the street lamp or whatnot. I'm gonna say street or like a telephone pole. Doesn't matter. They see him just sitting there, and yeah, very comforting. It's an easy watch, I would say. While it's still heavy and philosophical and existential, but you're flowing with it, you know?
Right, I love that we've already done the segment of alternating between picks for this, because...
For sure.
What, part of the reason I wanted to bring this back was I saw there was a lot of room to improve for the show. Like, oh, that sounds bad. Maybe don't use a Discord bot to record audio. That's a little amateur. Yeah, sure. Oh, maybe time the trailer a little bit earlier. But the big thing I wanted to do on this relaunch was I wanted to let Chandler take the reins.
Well, thank you, Jack.
I mean, there's a comfort I feel in leaning back and just letting you just dive into a film. But also, there's observations that I could often miss in the sidelines that you end up catching on to. Like, oh, wait, what about that? You're always a fun collaborator to bounce ideas off of it. But in hearing you come from this personal place with this, yeah, I'm glad we decided to cover Waking Life, even if, what, shit, I had a thought, I just lost it.
No worries, I appreciate that, man.
Even if it is an episode that is kind of, it's a weird movie to talk about, if I'm being honest, because everything you could say about it feels like it doesn't live up to it. It's an experiential thing. It's a, what, I don't like talking about this kind of one. Or at least I'd prefer to show this to other people. Well, because I'm like, I'd rather just let you have the experience on Vart. First and foremost, this, and then we get into the nitty gritty. And in the off chance you haven't seen this before this, what are you doing? Go watch Waking Life. It's wonderful.
Discussing it and trying to analyze it feels contradictory almost. Like you're contradicting the other elements of it, or you're trying to scrutinize it to where it, it's confined, like you're confining it. I don't know. I agree. I'd rather just like show this to someone. Not to say that this has been a fantastic discussion, which it has, but yeah.
There's,
I mean,
a point
I'd rather
where
just like show it to
just
someone.
Words feel like they fail.
And they do. Yeah, words feel like they fail. I'd rather show it to someone and like see them experience it, which I love doing. I love like curating movies for someone. In a very specific way, and like knowing that they're gonna love it, and having to know their taste and them personally. Yeah, it feels like a very personal film. It feels like full of heart, and like there's a lot of personal intention behind it, which is so charming and just so fun, intimate, honestly, because you're with a lot of these characters and they're being very vulnerable and kind of like pouring their heart out. But yeah, it's just, I love it. Yeah, go ahead.
I don't want to call it a verite property of the thing, but this is where I see the docu half of docudrama working in the thing, is that level of authenticity of, I don't care what you say, I'm not going to have any opinions, I just want it on the camera, whatever you do, open up. Enough. It's a move, and open up is a key word, because that's what I feel like whenever I go back to it, is there's always little things and little, not even just what they say, it's little micro expressions. I'm fascinated with, in this case, the poetry in between the lines. And I find that the older I get, the more I'm drawn to films with confounding, contradictory emotional states that make you feel everything at once and have a tendency to really go up and down on a tall high wire with it, because there's something honest to that. It's not always easy to explain. It's not always easy to reconcile, but there's truth to it, and it's satisfying.
Absolutely. And it feels more true to life in that sense too. Films that have like contradictory tones. I mean, the first thing I thought of again was Tree of Life, because it's, that entire film is so beautiful and life affirming, but also sad and dreary and, you know, glorifying, but kind of, you know, human hopelessness. And, I feel that about this film. Like it feels melancholic, at times, and kind of there's like a mysterious tone at play, but it's also so playful. So playful and, again, life affirming. Yeah, love it.
It's funny you mentioned Boyhood earlier, because I mean, there was a certain point, like I think like 40, 50 minutes into this rewatch, where I was thinking, hey, should I watch Boyhood again? I should probably watch Boyhood again. I haven't seen that in a decade.
Yeah, that's a springtime movie for me. I try to watch it every spring or every other spring, but I think we're going to have something at the theater for like the 10-year anniversary. Yeah, shout out Austin Film Society.
Gotta love Austin.
Yeah.
We are a pro-Austin podcast around these parts.
Old and new. There's also like a dazed and confused smiley face during the pinball sequence. And pinball is in a lot of his films. I can tell he loves pinball. And I think it's cool to see, you know, small little things like that appear in directors' films like throughout their entire body of work. You can just tell that like it's something they love and want to show. And I think it's cool that, you know, they just threw that in, the little dazed, confused, smiley face. But then we can talk about his monologue. Go for it.
It's funny that you mentioned that, and we've mentioned all the talk of Slacker being in conversation with this movie. And the thing that the pinball thing reminds me of is the other Linklater, and probably my personal favorite, having lived with it long enough. It's the spiritual successor to Dazed and Confused, the ultimate dudes rock movie, one could argue. Yeah, it's Everybody Wants Some. I was thinking of like the bits in the arcade where the guys are just down in beers, and the general, there's a camaraderie to it, and a sort of positive masculinity there. But also, oh, the general, there is a recreational feel to these movies. The thing I like about Linklater in terms of art house discussions is that it never ever feels like homework. Where if you want a way to get people into it, this is the way to go. Lure them in with something that feels comfortable, but something that's still challenging on a level that can really, it's never off-putting, or it never feels daunting or intimidating. It feels like Linklater is truly gifted as a filmmaker who can go on an audience's level and not have to compromise his voice.
Absolutely. I mean, I'd say all of his films, for the most part, are pretty experimental, art house, kind of indie movies. I mean, indie movies for sure, but...
like, what's the one exception? Like, his Bad News Bears remake, or...
Or, like, Last Flag Flying, or School of Rock, maybe, but... They're never pretentious. None of his films are ever pretentious, but he's still being so creative and... experimenting with the cinematic form and medium, which I love to see. And I mean, I've encountered him a few times personally and introduced myself, and he's such a laid back guy, like so laid back and like humble, and yeah, very humble.
And on that note of humility, I'm trying to remember the last time you told me this story. Was it true that he showed up to the AFS in cargo shorts?
Yes, he did, which I think is just so sick.
I love that detail so much. Truly a man of the people.
Yeah, I mean, his own theater. Just so cool. Such a stud. I don't know, just like a sense of like... You can see that in his films, too, and I love watching directors' interviews, hearing them speak on podcasts or whatnot. Even like the way they speak, their inflection and their tone translates directly to their cinematic style, which I love. I think it's such a cool point to like the creator and their creation. And you can see this with him too. Just such a laid back, down to earth dude. And you can see that here. He's being playful.
I would like to add, circling back around to the subject of Gen X filmmakers and interpreting the world around them, there is a diatribe that Jim Jarmusch went on years and years ago about how anything is really up for grabs in terms of what you choose to put into your work. Take inspiration from street signs, take inspiration from books. I'll put the full quote in the description for this, but this movie is like the fullest maximum effort extent of that thinking captured in one film.
Mm.
And on that note, did you notice the Soderbergh cameo at the end?
I don't think I did.
When he's the guy, the bald guy on the TV in the glass. The funny thing is, this is born out of that mentality, because I think it was just a conversation between Linklater and Soderbergh, and at a certain point, Linklater was thinking on, he's like, hey, do you mind just saying that in front of a camera for me?
Cool.
You know what I mean? For a little bit, that'd be great. Right? A lot of this really comes to a head, specifically at the beginning, but definitely a lot at the end. And there's another sequence, I think, like, right before that, where he was talking about seeing a woman sketching a guy in, what was it, Central Park, somewhere in New York, and, like, I should put that in. And there's an excitement and a feeling like everything is up, right, is worthy and considering of judgment. But inclusion, I guess is the way I'd put it.
Absolutely. Is Soderbergh the one that he's on the TV and he's talking about Billy Wilder?
He is.
Okay, cool. That's a great little bit. And I was thinking about that too this morning. I feel like he put that in to almost make fun of himself. This is an assumption for sure, but because this movie is like a dream within a dream. A few times, a few layers of that. And I don't know. I think it's a silly, commendable joke in there. Just kind of like poking fun at this movie, or like his attempt, like the attempt of this movie. I don't know. What do you think about that?
I also find it quite fitting, because obviously generational differences aside, I find Soderbergh and Linklater's approach is fairly similar in the core idea, even if it's not as comparable in like the individual movie to movie case by case base. This, because they're both guys constantly looking to improve themselves and play with toys that they haven't before. And really, there's an excitement and a passion there that consistently... It also was worth noting that these guys have worked fairly consistently since they've started. Like, a movie a year or a movie every 2 years. Like, they're fairly prolific. Like, on top of being bold and willing to try anything.
For sure. And there's some great bonus features on the DVD release, and some fantastic behind the scenes where Linklater's like doing the majority of the camera work, being the cameraman, which I think is just so beautiful and commendable to like the filmmaker spirit of, you know, he won all of these awards before this movie and got all this fame, but he's still just making movies, you know, just wants to make movies and doesn't mind holding the camera, and that's so awesome. It's just so cool. Some really funny bonus features.
I was wondering when we were going to get to the DVD, because that menu, it had been a while since I'd seen it. Like, that is peak 2000s menu design right there. And I just want to add, it's a shame that this thing doesn't have a Blu-ray and that the only HD version is when it pops in and out of streaming catalogs, because this is a wonderful looking movie and I would love to see a proper restoration done eventually.
Oh yeah, I could see the Criterion picking this one up.
I have my doubts about that, to be honest, because like a lot of films from this era, and funny enough, one of which was a Soderbergh title, it's an early to mid-2000s Fox title. And you know what titles are really bad with circulation over specifically the last 5 years? Early to mid-2000s Fox titles.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a... it's either like the animation test or... I think it's the animation test. There's a fantastic, deleted scene monologue. Okay, I'll say that again. There's a fantastic, deleted scene monologue of this guy, like, talking about getting out of jail, which is just hilarious. Like, you'll have to look it up. I don't want to quote it, but you'll have to watch it. But, yeah, he's just having fun. It's such a fun movie. Even when it is kind of jumpy... Tonally, I think it points further to the dreamlike state, and just like being a movie about dreams. And it's also very much like a buy the ticket, take the ride kind of movie, for sure. Cause it's going places. It's, you don't know where the next scene's going to lead, which is so fun.
It's fascinating how this is a movie bursting with youthful creative energy and life to it. But also, it's clearly a product of someone who has lived with this for a long time. There is a lot of wisdom and foresight to it, on top of feeling like a mad burst of creativity. Eddie. There's genuine experience baked into it. And on that note, I don't think there's a better note that I could praise this film for. Again, just go watch it. And even if you have seen it, watch it again. It's really worth it. And hell, if you watched it recently, throw it on again. Yeah, this is one that I think even more than my favorite Linklaters, this is the one to revisit.
Absolutely.
And really live with.
I want this to be on a rotation for me to throw on every few months. Because it's also very grounding. I mean, a lot of the conversations are about existence and reality, and I love thinking about that kind of thing, or like I love being in that headspace, and it puts you there, but in a such a casual, kind of streamlined way. And it's funny at times. It's really funny. Not just the Alex Jones bit, but there's some, I don't know, just some good jokes in there.
And not even all just through dialogue either. A lot of it is just weird visual details or like background extras or just the way something moves. Like, I love how they're, again, it's that visual elasticity. No one person moves like any other. And even with individual people like Wiley Wiggins, they tend to look different in individual scenes in a way that is exciting. There is a relaxed spontaneity to the thing.
Yeah, and it doesn't beat you over the head with, like, experimentalism also, which, you know, is my problem with a lot of, like, experimental films or short films. There's something just so casual and laid back about this approach to such, like, a heady subject and heady topics. And even, like, visual style.
So, on that note, man, I don't know what else to say. I just love this movie. I love, there are movies that everyone talk about. Oh, if you could live in a movie, what would it be? This is one of those titles that, like, I'd strongly consider this. This would be a pretty fun one to live in. And maybe not for the self-immolating parts, though, that I think, the road less traveled.
Yeah, but I mean, still there's some fun bits. I love the bookends also. I think that's probably the only way he could have ended that movie. It's like the bookends of him floating and then like not being able to hold onto the car and just floats away. It's beautiful.
That final shot really does stick with you. Yeah, man, just an absolute masterpiece of a film.
Oh yeah. And I adore his personal monologue at the end of like, you know, talking about the Philip K. Dick story, which you can tell he's a huge fan of Philip K. Dick, obviously.
As are we.
Yes. And, the God question and, like, just him, like, personally running through all of these topics. I think it's so beautiful and fantastic. And then I have a great question for us to end on, if you have nothing else to cover.
I'm pretty content. Ask away.
Yeah, I was talking to one of my coworkers about this, but like, which movie feels most like your dreams?
That is something I'm gonna have to give a moment of thought.
Yes, well, while you think, I will. I'll tell you mine. Definitely Inland Empire. Tonally, subject matter, visually, like the visual approach. Just kind of like some jerky handheld, some whip pans and like some, you know, like a constant, like fearful, anxious tone, like some like anxiety nightmares, which is funny. The coworker that I was talking to about this, he said that his movie was, the movie most like his dreams was Crash, Cronenberg's Crash. And I was like, nice.
Well, maybe you should be seeking some psychiatric help for those dreams in that case.
Yeah. No, I think
we're definitely gonna cover Crash at some point, right? Like, I feel like we have to. We got a Cronenberg coming up in a couple, right, in about a month. So
yeah, and I know
I will not say which one, other than I am very excited to talk about that one in particular.
Oh, I know you are. Yeah, I feel like that's a fantastic question of like an insight into someone and their psyche, but also like their relationship to film and. Yeah, what would you say?
My pick would... I'm oscillating between, like, three different titles. I am thinking a three-way tie between either John Boorman's Point Blank, Nicholas Roeg's The Man Who Fell to Earth, or Ken Russell's Altered States. Because mine, I mentioned the autism thing in the last episode, but I notice I tend to particularly respond to film with strong visual and auditory stimuli.
Yeah.
I'm gonna lie, things that just keep the brain active of introducing new ideas and just weaving them together. And the way it just, it crackles and electrifies your system. That is the way I would sum it up. But those also, it feels loose and not restricted into an individual time and place. They tend to blend together in the way memories from the past tend to linger on in the present. How that person may not be there, but you're still thinking about them in a way it feels like they are there. It's, again, that sort of elasticity.
Yeah, those are great answers. And that makes total sense.
This has been a great episode. If you want to catch up on past episodes, you can find us on iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Also, if you could leave a rating, that would be so wonderful. That's what helps us keep doing this. Keep spreading the word. If you have anything you want us to cover, please feel free to add us on Twitter at WarpCelluloid. You can find me and Chandler on Letterboxd. Links in the description, as always. And yeah, thanks for tuning in, everyone. Next week, we're going back to another Chandler pick and keeping things on schedule. We promise. We hope. This time, we are delving into a filmmaker we have yet to cover. Adam McGowan, and probably his masterpiece by my estimation. So yes, very excited to dig into that.
Oh yes. Talking about dreams, you know, there's a lot to cover in that one too. But
lot to unpack in that one.
Yeah, thanks for listening. We love doing this. It's a great time, Jack.
Peace out.
Good stuff.
Good shit.